if he's got a problem, he should be able to work that out without being involved in a lawsuit.
Lawmakers question the lawsuit Governor Walker filed over the Point Thompson settlement. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, Keegan Randall regroups after a tough start to the World Cup racing season.
I've been laughing a little bit because of, you know, often talking in presentations about the importance of focusing on the positive, and I feel like I've been having to listen to my own advice a little bit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Attorneys challenging the Point Thompson settlement have requested more time to prepare a new brief on the case. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports the delay has rankled legislative leaders who think it's inappropriate for Governor Bill Walker to remain a plaintiff in an ongoing lawsuit against the state.
Bill Walker filed the Point Thompson lawsuit in 2012 when he was still an attorney in private practice. He thought it was inappropriate for the state to make a deal with Exxon to develop the North Slope gas field without getting public input or seeking legislative approval. But now that Walker has been elected governor and the lawsuit has been transferred to the firm Brenna, Bell & Clarkson, the Alaska Supreme Court has asked for additional information on the proceedings. The court set a deadline of January 30th. But on Friday, attorney Robin Brenna asked for an extension to mid-March. Brenna says the firm needs extra time to review the case and see what legal options are available to them.
The case was recently just transferred from Walker and Richards to Brenna, Bell & Clarkson. And so the primary reason was to give us an opportunity to get up to speed and also give an opportunity for the council just to chat and see if there's any alternatives to litigation.
The Point Thompson settlement was a major point of contention during the gubernatorial campaign. The original agreement was approved by former Governor Sean Parnell, and it established a development plan for North Slope Reserves that would supply a proposed natural gas megaproject. Parnell, a Republican, criticized Walker for filing the public interest lawsuit, arguing that it could jeopardize development of the field. Walker called the settlement, quote, the dirtiest backroom deal in state history, but ultimately said he would drop his lawsuit against the state if elected governor. Walker's name remains on the lawsuit, but he's delegated his office's authority to act on Point Thompson to Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott. In a written statement, Walker maintains the deal was illegal and that he is not in an immediate hurry to drop the case. Attorney Robin Brenna says the extension request is not a sign in either direction.
I don't think the reading tea leaves beyond that is helpful at this point.
Well, I think they always say that, don't read much into the tea leaves until the thing's over with or until you're in a position where you can't affect the outcome of it.
House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Nikiski Republican, thinks the lawsuit has already gone on too long.
You know, you got the governor as the governor of the state of Alaska, and now you have the governor as a plaintiff against the state of Alaska. So I think it just sends a bad message.
On Thursday, the day before Brenna, Bell, and Clarkson filed for an extension, Chenault sent the governor a letter requesting that the lawsuit be dropped because of the conflict. He says continuing the lawsuit and extending the briefing timeline creates uncertainty for industry. Chenault adds that with Walker's executive authority, it would be more appropriate for the governor to pursue a legislative remedy instead of asking for resolution in the courts.
He is the governor of the state of Alaska. He is the head man. And if he's got a problem, he should be able to work that out without being involved in a lawsuit.
Chenault says he has not received a response to his letter from the office of the governor. Walker, who is traveling to New York to meet with credit rating agencies, was unavailable for comment, as was the attorney handling the case for the state. The court has yet to decide whether it will grant the extension. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Governor Bill Walker has filed his supplemental budget. It covers the money that was spent during the current fiscal year but was not originally appropriated. The budget includes $92 million for Medicaid payments that weren't given to doctors because of problems with the state's billing system. It cuts $52 million in one-time education funding. The supplemental budget also includes language that would help facilitate the state's purchase of the Fairbanks Natural Gas Utility. Walker announced the purchase last week. Walker's endorsed budget for the new fiscal year has not yet been released in full. It is due to the legislature by February 18th. A program that distributes millions of dollars a year to keep homeless and emergency shelters open across the state is nowhere to be seen in Governor Bill Walker's budget. It leaves dozens of organizations scrambling for the money they'll need to keep their doors open. KNOM's Matthew Smith has more.
The Basic Homeless Assistance Program, or BHAP, provides anywhere from $5.5 to $6 million a year to emergency shelter and transitional housing programs all across Alaska. Last year, 40 organizations were funded through the program in 20 communities across the state. The money pays for anything from staffing costs to social work. And every year, the grant helps more than 13,000 of Alaska's most vulnerable, an increasing number of whom are children. Sue Steinecker is with the Nome Emergency Shelter Team, or NEST, the only shelter in the Bering Strait-Norton Sound region. She says the BHAP grant covers two-thirds of the shelter's expenses, providing the funding the shelter needed to get off the ground and still needs to stay open.
For NEST, it has been huge. It is the grant that really got us up and running. It is far and away the largest grant that we receive.
But the yearly BHAP grants could soon disappear, one of the casualties of the state's $3.5 billion budget crisis. Money for the grant isn't in Governor Bill Walker's budget. Mark Romick with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which administers the funds, says there's no backup plan if the BHAP program ends.
There is no money in the homeless assistance program. And if there is no money in the fund at the end of the process in the legislative session, then there won't be any money for us to distribute to the grantees.
In cities like Anchorage, losing BHAP grants would impact shelters like Brother Francis, as well as Clare House, which shelters women and children. Catholic Social Services Director Lisa Aquino says at those shelters, the BHAP money goes directly to case management.
Those case management services are really the ladder out of homelessness. And without this grant funding, that ladder is going to disappear.
But at smaller shelters, like the NEST shelter back in Nome, the BHAP grants can make the difference between having an emergency shelter or not.
If we have no other funds to supplement the loss of this grant, it would come very close to shutting down the shelter. It is that significant a grant to our operations.
For now, Steinecker says NEST can redirect its local donations to keep the shelter running, but that comes at the expense of the shelter's other programs, like sober housing and other homeless prevention efforts. Aquino with Catholic Social Services says the way forward is through engaging with lawmakers in Juneau and making the case that funding the state's shelters and homeless programs should be a top priority. The group of organizations representing BHAP grantees plans to meet with budget officials in Juneau soon, and Romick with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation says they're meeting to review the agency's needs with House and Senate Finance Committees on Friday. Until then, shelters large and small in communities across Alaska are waiting to see if they'll have the funds needed to keep their doors open for another year. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
The Senate today unanimously passed a bill aimed at preventing suicide among veterans. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan on the Senate floor said it's an important bill for Alaska, which has the highest number of vets per capita and also the highest rate of suicide.
As an officer in the Marine Corps, both on active duty and in the reserves, I've personally witnessed the struggles, at times tragic, that some of our servicemen and women undergo.
The bill is named for Clay Hunt, a Marine veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan who killed himself in 2011. The legislation calls for a review of military and VA suicide prevention programs, financial incentives to help recruit psychiatrists to the VA, and a better website to show the mental health resources available. According to the VA, some 22 veterans commit suicide each day. Senator Sullivan, in his Senate speech, said it's a personal issue for him.
The suicide of a young Alaskan Marine under my command still haunts me. You always wonder, could I have done more?
Sullivan paused for 10 seconds, fighting for composure.
With the proper awareness and resources, this Marine might be alive today.
The bill passed the House last month, also unanimously, and now heads to the president for signature. The bill had widespread support last year, too, but was blocked by then-Senator Tom Coburn, who objected to the cost, $22 million over 5 years. The Oklahoma Republican has since retired from office. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Beth Cartula remembers her mom, Joyce, who ran her husband's legislative office.
If you have someone working with you who you trust implicitly and who really is a, frankly, a second legislator, you can get a lot done.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
The budget President Obama sent Congress this week includes $1 million for the Office of the Federal Coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. But the current coordinator, Larry Persily, says he's still shutting down his offices in Anchorage and Washington, D.C.
We are giving away the furniture and equipment to other federal agencies through surplus property, archiving records, and trying to get it all done by February 28th, give or take a couple days either way.
The problem is that the budget proposal is for the 2016 fiscal year, which starts in the fall. The office has no appropriation for the current year and is running on leftover money from prior years. Despite the president's $1 million budget request, Persily says restarting the office in the fall is far from certain. The Alaska Railroad is among a few across the country seeking first-ever approval to transport liquefied natural gas. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Alaska Railroad Vice President of Business Management and Corporate Affairs Wendy Linskook says an application is being filed this week with the Federal Railroad Administration.
Seeking an approval to haul liquefied natural gas in what we call ISO tanks or ISO containers. Those ISO containers would be filled with LNG, put onto flat cars, and then moved to Fairbanks.
Linskook says the Alaska Railroad began looking into moving natural gas from Anchorage to Fairbanks via rail, following interest from producers and potential shippers. Getting gas to Fairbanks by train has been attracting attention in recent weeks since Governor Bill Walker refocused the state-backed Interior Energy Project on Cook Inlet gas and pointed to rail as his preferred means for moving the resource north. Federal Coordinator for Alaska Gas Line Projects Larry Persily says transporting gas by train is a new concept driven by growing demand across the country.
To get it to customers where there's no pipeline access. It's probably more economical, smaller volumes, moving it by rail, moving it by truck.
Persily lists Lower 48 based railroads Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Union Pacific, and Florida East Coast Railway as also seeking federal approval to move LNG by train. The Alaska Railroad's Linskook says transporting LNG by truck may be a better first step until the Fairbanks gas market matures.
As the volume grows to certain levels, it becomes more economic to ship by rail than it would by truck.
Linskook expects it to take 3 to 6 months for the Federal Railroad Administration to rule on the request. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Since December, a few intrepid Cook Inlet fishermen have been trying something new. They've been fishing for pollock in state waters using seine gear. It's an experiment to determine the viability of establishing a future fishery in the area. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver spent a day aboard the Sea Prince to see how the experiment is working.
We set out from the Homer Harbor before sunrise. The crew of the 58-foot Sea Prince organizes gear on deck under a floodlight as we chug into Kachemak Bay. In the wheelhouse, Captain Rob Nelson is preparing for the first set. He's not totally sure where or when to set the net.
It'd be great if we kind of knew exactly what to expect and, you know, and how to gear up and everything, but somebody's got to go first, I guess.
The Sea Prince and one other vessel, the Silver Streak, are the only two boats that have gone out so far. It is a risky venture, after all, to put time and money into something that might not pan out. And that's the bare bones of this experimental fishery, to test the waters for potential and figure out the particulars along the way. That's one of the reasons Elisa Russ is on board today. She's an assistant area management biologist for Fish and Game.
Definitely that has been the impetus with having every single trip observed with a Department of Fish and Game observer on board to monitor the bycatch as well as the effectiveness of the gear and how the fishery is prosecuting.
Chinook bycatch has been a huge concern for fishermen and biologists alike. Since the fishery started in December, there have been 45 kings caught. Russ says all but two were released unharmed, and those didn't go to waste.
And so any that are caught and killed, which as I said was two, then I'm processing for sampling and taking genetic information from, and then I've been donating them to the Homer Food Bank.
The majority of the bycatch has been herring, jellyfish, and the occasional Pacific cod, and numbers are lower than initially expected. Captain Nelson says the other thing that's been lower than expected is the pollock.
The fish are in the deep, you know, they're out this time of year, they're out in the, you know, out in the deep hole, so it's kind of out of our reach unless they really come up. You know, so you can see the potential, you know, with a little deeper net, you could go out and fish, you know, right out in the middle and probably catch some real volume doing that.
The Sea Prince can fish down to about 150 feet, whereas the Silver Streak is limited to 75 feet. And so far, the numbers reflect the net size. During the 7 trips the boats completed in December, the Sea Prince caught more than 10 times the amount of pollock as the Silver Streak, and the combined total of 11,400 pounds was still only a fraction of the 220,000-pound GHL for 2014. To date, just over 30,000 pounds have been caught total. Captain Nelson says there is good biomass, but lots of other contributing factors have come into play, like tides, time of day, temperature, and depth. But he says the biggest challenge so far has actually been what to do with the fish once it's caught.
Just started slower, you know. It's one of those things we figured we were going to be kind of, you know, hot and heavy into it at the beginning. And then market-wise, it's just kind of, you know, that's kind of been a little slow.
They really need to diversify who they've been selling to because the markets have been so slim in the fall. So I think they're hoping that with the opening of the trawl pollock fisheries, the big fisheries in the state for pollock, this will hopefully allow them more options for where to sell their fish.
The majority has gone to the bait market at 30 to 40 cents a pound, and he's sold some to the South Korean fresh market as well. Nelson plans to deliver today's catch to the auction block in Homer. In the 10 hours we're out fishing, they catch a grand total of 3,872 pounds. It's not the most they've done, and not the least. With the sun well below the horizon, the Sea Prince stows its gear and heads back to town. We head inside a warehouse where people are busy opening up the totes and throwing fish. There's also a surprise visitor. Beaver Nelson is the captain's father, who's come to see how his son fared today. He also sits on the Gulf of Alaska Pollock Work Group. It was created to stimulate discussion about opening state waters to seining for the species. Pollock is caught predominantly in the federal trawl fisheries, but he says recently there's been interest in new avenues.
And there's other areas, Sandpoint, Kodiak, and King Cove, those areas are all interested in possibly seining for pollock also. So this fishery is basically to determine if seining is a feasible way to capture pollock other than trawling, and a safer way, possibly with much less bycatch than trawling would involve.
There's still a lot up in the air. There are a lot of unknowns, and it's still a risk. but Captain Rob Nelson says it's worth it.
Might not even be a profitable venture the first year, but at least, you know, it'll be a start, and you got to start somewhere, and we'll know where to go from here. But the first thing is to show that it can be done.
He and other fishermen have until the end of February to do just that. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Alaska Pacific University skier Keegan Randall has spent 3 years on top of the World Cup sprint standings. This season has been different. She struggled to make even the top 10 in races. Randall's back in Europe now after spending a few weeks in Anchorage to regroup. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
Keegan Randall was skeptical when her coach Eric Flora suggested she fly back to Anchorage from Europe in the middle of the World Cup racing season.
At first, I have to admit, I thought he was a little crazy.
But she came around to the idea of having a chance to refocus in the comfort of her home city. She says she ate seafood, played with her cats, and trained at Kincaid and Hillside.
It was really, really good just to see friends and family and get back in a good training environment, and I really felt like that was the break I needed.
Randall's early results on the World Cup have been disappointing. Her best finish so far is 9th in a sprint race in December in Switzerland. Randall is coming off of last year's Olympics, where she was the favorite to win the skate sprint, but finished far out of the medals. Then in the spring and summer, she thinks she trained too hard, hoping to prove she could peak properly for this year's World Championships.
I don't think I rested enough coming off of a big Olympic year, and then just carried a little bit too much fatigue to the summer and the fall. And by the time I kind of realized that I was under some fatigue, we were already into the racing season. And so I was trying to balance resting with the racing. And it just hasn't allowed me to really find my peak form.
Until this year, Randall's career has been a steady progression to become the best female sprint skier in the world. She says things were going so well, she got a little complacent, thinking that trend would continue. Now she's experiencing a new kind of challenge, not performing to her own or the world's expectations.
I've been laughing a little bit because of, you know, often talk in presentations about, you know, the importance of focusing on the positive and focusing on the process and the little things you can do each day that build up to your big goals. And I feel like I've been having to listen to my own advice a little bit.
The big goal this season is the World Championships, which start in Falun, Sweden on February 18th. Randall and her U.S. teammate Jesse Diggins are the defending world champions in the team sprint event. Randall says it's a gamble whether her form will be back to 100%, but she's excited to get back to racing.
I don't really know or plan to really put hard expectations down. I think I just want to make sure my body's in a good place and go out and race with what I have. And if things go well, it could be some good results.
Alaska Pacific University head coach Eric Flora isn't worried about Randall's performance. He says it's common for elite athletes who have long-term success to occasionally take a step back and have a rebuilding year. He says in the long run, one subpar season shouldn't matter much for Randall's career, even if it's hard to see it that way right now.
With Sochi being a fairly big goal and a lot of the training leading up to it, you know, post-Sochi, kind of taking a year to adjust, having a bit of an off year. And I'm sure when we look back on it, it's not a big deal at all.
Flora says the EPU ski team as a whole is having one of its best seasons ever, with breakout performances on the World Cup from Rosie Brennan and Sadie Bjornsson. Both will compete in the World Championships alongside Keegan Randall, who couldn't be more thrilled with the success of her teammates. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Joyce Kertula died Monday at age 91 after a long fight with lymphoma, but not before helping two generations of Kertulas rise to political power in the state. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
Beth Kurtula likens her mom to a 61st legislator who made Jay Kurtula's historic rise to power possible.
My dad's the only guy to have ever been both Speaker and President of the Senate. And I just, you know, I never could figure out how he could have ever done that until I was in and realized, you know, it's because of my mother. If you have someone working with you who you trust implicitly and who works side by side and who really is a, frankly, a second legislator, you can get a lot done. And that's what happened. They were a tremendous team.
Beth Kurtula represented Juneau in the Alaska State House for 15 years. Jay Kurtula represented Palmer in the Alaska Legislature for 34 years, and Joyce Kurtula worked alongside him as an unpaid volunteer for almost that entire time. In a 2014 interview, Joyce recalled how her unofficial career in the legislature began with an office visit. His secretary pulled open, then shut, a desk drawer that was full of papers.
And I said, "Would you mind telling me what was in that drawer?" And she says, "Oh, that's letters that I don't know how to answer, and I'll get to them one of these days." And I said, "Would you mind if I looked at one of them?" And I pulled one out at the bottom, not the top, and it was over a month old. And I said, "This can't go on."
And my mom just sat down and started writing letters on one of those old Underwood typewriters, and she just kept going, and that was it.
30-some years later, she was still at it.
And so my mother handled the offices and handled all the campaigns and handled constituents.
In her obituary, the family calls Joyce Kurtula the heart and soul of her husband's legislative offices. Originally from Oklahoma, she was born Helen Joyce Campbell in 1923. After finishing college, she left Oklahoma to be a personal assistant to a scientist working on the Manhattan Project in New Mexico, where she witnessed a test detonation of an atomic bomb. She moved to Alaska in 1954 and taught English at Palmer High School. She met and married Jay in 1955. Joyce Kurtula's unofficial career in the Alaska legislature began after he was sworn into office in 1961. An Alaska memorial service is in the works for the summer. She had been living in Palmer, but was in Palm Springs, California, for medical care when she died.
My mother used to say, "You've got to live every day," and I'm going to try to emulate that a little bit better. So.
She is survived by her husband, daughters, a sister, two grandchildren, and a large extended family. In Juneau, with help from Rosemarie Alexander, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Artist, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.